I'm Erica Ensign.
And I'm Lisa Schmeiser.
And we welcome you back to Saga of Rereading Epics, in which we are rereading, reconsidering, and re-feeling Julian May's Saga of Pliocene Exile and Galactic Milieu series. And for this episode, we have reread the first book in the Saga of Pliocene Exile, The Many-Colored Land. So, Lisa, have you reconsidered and or re-felt this book?
So many things. Yes. Yes, I have. Erica, I had a question for you. This is a reread for you as well, yes?
Yes.
So when you first read these books, how old were you and where were you in life?
You know what? I was talking to my mom earlier today who suggested these books to me, and she asked me that very same question. And I'm glad she did because I had to think about it. It had to have been just after high school, like the summer after high school, or possibly the first year of college, because I remember reading this book while I was at my job at a movie theater in Muskego, Wisconsin. And that's the time that I worked there. So I must have just, and I was, and I will cop to the fact that I was a very sort of, I was a young college student. I was very immature. So I feel like, mm-hmm. For a lot of people, the mindset that I had might have been even, you know, high school-ish at that time.
So I feel like this podcast was made to be because that was pretty much my situation too. Ah. I read these books my first semester of college. And I did fine with college academically and with time management, blah, blah, blah. But I think I was probably behind the curve when it came to emotional and social milestones. Mm-hmm. So when I read these books, I read them as an 18-year-old single girl practicing Catholic. That was my first run through on these books. And I have to say, coming back to it as a 40-something married person has been just a whole different experience in terms of like, which characters resonate with me and how much sympathy I have for different characters and what stories I find most interesting now.
Yes.
And most relatable. Like the first time I read these stories, I hadn't had my heart broken yet by anybody. I hadn't committed to anybody. I hadn't had anybody close to me die yet. So I hadn't suffered that kind of loss or understood that loss at all. And I hadn't ever really lived on my own and or had to figure out like who I was as an adult or where I fit in the world. And now that I've had all of those experiences coming back, I found that I had a lot more sympathy for some characters than I had previously. It was nice because the first time I read the books, I'm like, oh God, Elizabeth, come on.
And now you get it.
I do. I get it in a way I did not get it at 18. And I think for that reason alone, the reread is worth it because it was nice to be able to reconsider these characters. And it also pointed out to me an important thing to chew on, which is how successful or not successful is an author if you can't connect with the experiences until you've had similar experiences. Like, is that a limitation of the way the author has presented their work, or is that kind of a limitation of your own empathy and imagination?
That's an interesting thought. Or is she really successful in this case because she had some characters that we were able to glom onto as youngsters, mm-hmm. and other characters that now that we have evolved as people,
yes.
Mm-hmm. that we are able to understand and relate to a little bit better. I think for me, the one that changed the most was Brian, because when I was first reading this book, I just thought that here, you know, him chasing after this woman who we never actually see again for the rest of this book, except for the very beginning part, was just so romantic. And now I'm like, creepy stalker, red flag. So it's a... Yeah, it's changed.
Oh, do we want to talk about the book first and then characters and our reactions, or can we just like kind of go into the personnel?
Yeah.
Because basically the first third of the book is about quote unquote Group Green, which includes the Brian character. So maybe if we talk about what Group Green is and who's in that group and how we respond to them, that may be a handy way to jump into the conversation.
Yes, I think that is good. Because the book is set out in three parts, and part one is very much an introduction to all of the different characters bit by bit. Although actually before that, there's a prologue, which I had completely forgotten existed at all. My memory of this book was that we had the these characters and we were being introduced to them in sort of like the now time, what modern life is. And I had totally forgotten that we had this little prologue that's actually got the aliens right up front, crash landing on Earth, and a little bit of a hint about what the heck the Torque is, because you have a Ramapithecus chasing her son and him freaking out. And I think maybe as intended, I had completely forgotten about that by the time by the time we got around to the surprise of, oh, there's aliens here in the past. So I'm definitely happy to just jump in with part one, which is known as the leave taking, and introduces us to all these characters.
Yeah, it lays out the basic premise, which is that humanity has become part of a galactic community where most of society's major problems have been solved. But there's a trade-off, which is there's kind of a species-by-species conformity. You have to have a common language, so only one language per species. And humans voted on English, which does not sit well with, you know, say, the French. Mm-hmm. And they also have certain expectations for how your life is supposed to go. For example, the guy who finds out that he can, in fact, build a time gate from this very specific spot in France in the now to this very specific spot in France 6 million years ago. He complains, and this is the quote, "We have had to give up so much. Our diverse languages, many of our social philosophies and religious dogmata, our so-called non-productive lifestyles, our very human sovereignty, laughable though its loss must seem." Like, so there are people who are like, well, sure, we have infinitely renewable energy and everybody's working their potential and we can all tap into this thing called unity, which is like this elevated state of consciousness and being. But there's been trade-offs, and some people are really unhappy about the trade-offs. This dude manages, Guderian manages to discover the time travel gate. The limits are, of course, it's only for one specific spot in the whole world at one specific time in the whole world. And, but his, later after he dies, this German poet approaches his widow and he's like, "I just want to go to the past and live out the rest of my years among the Ramapithecines, because I hate the present. I hate the century. Just let me read my poetry in the prehistoric Alps." And she's like, "Nah." And he's like, "I have money." And she's like, "Then feel free." And so by the time we get to the first part of the book, there's this thriving industry where people who feel like misfits in the here and the now jump to the past. And so we have, and Madame, or rather her estate, because she walks through the gate at a point pre-narrative. The estate sends people through in groups of eight, like they're bonded to each other through like boot camp exercises and survival skill exercises, things like that. And these eight characters are pretty much our point of view characters for the whole first book. And they include Richard, who is a xenophobe spacefarer, who was prosecuted and impoverished after, like, again, xenophobic, after his decision to let a spacecraft full of aliens die. Like, he heard the distress call in space and was like, "I hate your species," and kept going. And that violated galactic law. So he loses everything. And rather than commit suicide, which was what he thought his first thing post losing occupation, post legal troubles, post money troubles, he was like, "Meh, I'll just go back to the past and live out my days there." So he's the first person.
To Richard, in his slight, very slight defense, he did plan on going back to save those aliens, but he had to make his delivery first. So it was money over the life of aliens, and they would have died had somebody else not saved them. So just because there's later you get a glimpse into his head, and it's really ugly, and it's not fun. But I feel like that's at least worth stating.
That's a good point. Yeah, because I was like, he kind of condemned them to murder and moved on. Yeah. And then there's Stein Olsen, who is a deep earth, who's a deep crust driller on planet Earth, and openly longs for like the good old days of, say, 800 AD, when he could have been a Norse raider pillaging the coasts and burning down villages and violating people. Like, he's gotten kicked out of like cultural recreation pageants for being too violent. And it's just clear that the disconnect he feels to the shared cultural values people have now. Like, he's just deeply unhappy, which is why he goes. Paradoxically, that's why a woman named Mercy Lumbal, who Brian is chasing after, that's why she mm-hmm. goes, because we do get a point of view passage from her early in the book too, where she's responsible for these historical cultural recreations. And she's just miserable. Like, this poor woman is longing for this life in this world. Like, she's had this lifelong feeling of not fitting in. Mm-hmm. And she's miserable about it. And finally she decides that she's like, you know what? Again, go into the past, because if I don't fit in here, maybe at least I can be miserable in a new location. She leaves, but like right before she goes, like Brian falls head over tea kettle, or rather mm-hmm. he becomes fantastically obsessed with her. I don't feel comfortable saying he falls in love with her, because I don't think that's it. They spent one night together.
He doesn't even really know her.
No. And the whole time she says, well, I could use a distraction for the night. And he's like, yes, sure. Like, completely misses the point that she's managed his expectations from the word go with, she's like, and I cannot emphasize this enough, you are basically to keep me from feeling miserable for 40 minutes.
mm-hmm. Yep.
But she hops through, and then Brian becomes obsessed with her. And he quotes an old ballad about how his love was passing fair by just once, and once was all it took, and now he's hopelessly ensnared by her. And again, when you're 18, you're like, oh my gosh, it's courtly love.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's positively Arthurian. And now I'm like, oh no.
Which, and it ends up being very interesting, because as mm-hmm. we'll get to, like, all of these other characters have very personal reasons about themselves and their own feelings and the way that they feel, reasons for going into the past. Whereas Brian, it seems like if he hadn't met Mercedes, he would have been perfectly fine continuing to live in this, you know, galactic milieu and being okay with it. He only goes to find this woman. And also, he's an anthropologist. So it's mm-hmm. it's very interesting to see sort of his point of view once we get into the past, because he's really approaching it more as a scientist and not as somebody who dove in because he wanted to be a Viking and, you know, mm-hmm. wear the hat with horns and stuff like Stein.
Yeah, because so it's interesting because you've got Richard, who's basically out trying to escape his consequences because his actions and his consequences have made him miserable. You've got Stein, who feels grossly out of step with the world around him and has some sort of deep psychological injury that mm-hmm. we get to, like, in the second part of the book. You have Brian, who seems to have lost all sense and walked away from a nominally fulfilling life after one night with a deeply unhappy woman. The fourth member of your party is someone who I've always liked him. I liked him when I was 18. I like him now. Aiken Drum. He's he's basically consider one of society's incorrigibles. And when he turns 21, they give him a choice. Let me see if I tag that, because it's
I've got it. He has a choice between having a incarceration, because he's just like he keeps doing things that are, you know, it's not like they're harming people, but they're bad. Or
they're disruptive.
Could have,
yeah.
Yes. He could have a limiting implant put in his brain so that he's
so
not
he's
able
basically
to do
like
those
lobotomized.
Things. Yep. Mm-hmm. Or euthanasia. Like, those are his choices, and he says, nope.
21.
Yeah. I'm going to take the other one. I'm going to go to exile, which he is. He's very much like the charming rogue.
He's the trickster archetype. Mm-hmm. And what I also find really interesting about Aiken Drum is, and this comes out early, is the fact that when Aiken is told, you don't fit into society, these are your three choices for your future, he's like, I reject all of your choices and I substitute my own. And I think that tells you something about Aiken Drum right there, period, which mm-hmm. is that if you give him a situation, he'll go along if he sees no reason not to. But if he doesn't like a situation or the choices, he just refuses to deal with other people's ultimatums. And without spoiling it, we see that pretty much time and again through this book.
Yeah, he's like Captain Kirk, like Kobayashi Maruing all over the place, basically.
Yes,
is Aiken Drum.
And you know, there's And I'm sure I'm not the only one who's like, oh, there's lawful neutral, chaotic neutral. Like, Aegon is genuinely chaotic neutral when you meet him, and yep. and through most of the first book. So that's he's your element of chaos.
You gotta have one. You gotta have
an agent of chaos. Yes, yes. So Aegon, your agent of chaos is number four, and then we get into. Speaking from going from chaotic neutral to chaotic evil, you've got Felice.
Oh, who what is a name.
This? Well, it's Felice, which is a really ironic name because it's Felice, Felicity, Happiness. And as it turns out, she is, it's really heavily implied during her introduction that she's at the very least emotionally damaged. Mm-hmm. And we know that she sublimates a lot of it through violence. She's a very successful professional athlete. And by the time that she gets to the chalet, we see that she wants to go back in the past because in the present, redactors, i.e. healers, redactors have been like, your brain is all sorts of spaghetti. We really need to iron it out. And she doesn't want anyone mucking about her head. Mm-hmm. So... She said, and in what is a chilling sequence in the book, they're like, no, you're too young. You're 18. You can't possibly know. The only people who go back at your age are violent recidivists. And she's like, oh, then it's easy. And so she leans forward and snaps the guy's collarbones with her thumbs.
Yep. Yeah, like, she cool. is from the very first moment that we meet her playing. Mm-hmm. She's from a Canadian colony, which kind of made yes. me laugh. And she plays ring hockey, which is way different from either ringette or hockey because it uses giant beasts that she's very. Mm-hmm. She has this. She seems to have a relationship with the beasts that is stronger than her relationship with any people. She's vicious and she is disconnected from other humans, especially mm-hmm. men. It seems she's like possibly sociopathic, psychopathic just from the very first time that we see her. And then you're right, I was just as chilled as you were by that second sequence with her when she is sitting with the counselor who is trying to very kindly explain to her, no, you're not allowed to go. And yes, there's just the coolness with which mm-hmm. she gets up and crosses the room and just leans over and just snap, which mm-hmm. also demonstrates another thing about her, which she has an enormous amount of physical strength. She's stronger than anybody yeah. else. She's like almost superhero level strength yeah, that she can just snap.
Inhumanly strong for some yeah. reason, and that's never explained. It's never explained if it's well. It's never explained why. At least not in this book. Mm-hmm. So we yeah. have Felice, and then in terms of more damaged women, we also have Elizabeth, who mm-hmm. is.
She was physically damaged.
She was physically damaged. Like the thing about Elizabeth is, she and her late husband were in what amounts to a terrible flying car accident. They're called Eggs. They lived on the colony planet of Denali, so lots and lots of winters all the time. She and her husband got into a terrible accident. He was killed. She had to be thrown in what's called a regeneration tank and basically rebuilt from scratch. Like, there was just some of her brain left, and that was about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's actually... I jotted down the one of her descriptions of that. She says, a few teaspoons full of my original cerebrum survived, and then the rest had to be regenerated. And then she said, yeah. she says, the leavening was enough for a resoul job, and a specialist restored my memories. I'm like, what? Yes.
Well, because what that also suggests, though, is the reason Elizabeth's coming back is the accident erased her metapsychic abilities. Mm-hmm. You're going to hear the word metapsychic thrown around a lot when we talk about these books, because one of the core tenets of Julian May's culture with where all the aliens have gotten together, they live in harmony, is they have something called unity, where entities with metapsychic abilities, meaning the ability to they have extra senses, like they're mm-hmm. telepathic or they're telekinetic, or they can rearrange molecules simply by thinking about it, or they can heal simply by visualizing the injury and then knowing how to cure it. There's like one or two more that I'm forgetting at the moment.
Illusion, coercion. And creativity mm-hmm. and coercion. Yes. Yeah. So there's a lot of different ways that you can use the power of your mind to influence yeah. the people and things around you.
So Elizabeth was actually a full participant in Unity. She had metapsychic abilities, and she used those abilities to teach children how to attain Unity. And from what it sounds like, Unity is like... Unity is basically like a combination of a really good meditation session plus endorphins plus like the flow state of working. And just imagine like feeling really feeling like 100% your best self in Unity. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what's going on.
And being emotionally connected to billions of other people who are also feeling emotionally their best self. So it's like a giant intergalactic hug all the time.
Yeah. So not only is Elizabeth bereaved of her companion, Elizabeth is bereaved of the Unity. So she doesn't even have any support, from the people or the entities that would have supported her before. So she's reeling from quite literally the loss of all of her identities, because she's lost her avocation, she's lost her vocation, she's lost her partner, she's lost her metaphysical abilities. And she's like, you know what? I'm going to the past. I'm getting a hot air balloon. I'm just floating above all the ramapithecine. That is how I will spend my days, because I feel so isolated and untethered. I'm just going to float. I'm going to be the physical manifestation of the metaphor that I use to describe myself. So that's poor Elizabeth. And then your last two are an inadvertent pair, because it's a widowed paleontologist named Claude. And then a nun she's a nun, right? Or a priest?
Yep, she is a nun.
Okay. And it's a nun slash physician named Amari. Mm-hmm. Amari was getting burnt out on the hospice work that she did. And she had decided, I'm burnt out, I'm going to go be a hermit. And unfortunately, none of the surviving religious orders in the milieu would take her in, because they said she wasn't psychologically suited for any of them. And she's I don't think there's any BS psych tests among the ramapithecines.
We've got this galactic milieu with all of this Unity. So everything that is sort of religious that is left on Earth and elsewhere is all pointing toward togetherness and unity. Mm-hmm. And she really wants to become. I mean, she is her full name is Sister Anna Maria Roccaro, and she wants to become a spiritual hermitess, like in the old days. But those types of things have sort of been wiped out by Earth's, envelopment into the galactic milieu. So her only choice is to go back in time and be a spiritual hermitess back before there was anybody to tell her no, basically.
Yeah. And Claude comes along because, as he points out, I'm a paleontologist. This would be great. Mm-hmm. I can think of no better way to spend the rest of my years. I will happily be the dude who comes and brings you locusts and honey and takes care of things while you hermit away.
And he knows her because his wife died kind of a long Genevieve. And painful death. And his sister Amory was the one who ministered to them in the hospice. She was a hospice worker. So they developed a strong friendship over the course of Genevieve's death. So at that point, Claude really doesn't have anything else left in his life anyway. So when Amory says, I'm going into exile, he's like, I could get to see all of these fossils with flesh and, scales and feathers on their bones. That would be kind of cool. I'll go along with you. That's all right.
Yeah. And this is what make him and Amory special, I think, with this group, too, is again, Brian goes because he's obsessed with Mercy. Claude goes because he genuinely feels called to be a companion to his friend. Mm-hmm. And there's an element of selflessness there to it. He goes from being a good husband to being a good friend, as it were.
Yeah.
And the paleontology thing also comes in really handy, because what that means is from a narrative perspective, the paleontology thing comes in super handy, because it means that you'll have somebody who can science it up and give you lots of explanations, and it makes lots of sense within the context of the story.
Mm-hmm. And in this future society, you can get regeneration, which means that you don't have to age as much. Like, you can be rejuvenated. I think it's rejuvenation. Yeah. And he has done this. So he's about 133 years old. So he's not just an exopaleontologist. He is a paleontologist that has been doing this for a very long time, so he knows a lot.
Yeah. And so you've got your eight point of view people, and again, the first third of the book is basically dedicated to explaining the premise, which is that the human culture has changed, and not everybody has been able to change with it. There is an escape valve. You get to go back. Everybody who goes back is under the impression that they're going back to a place that is unspoiled, and they'll have the opportunity to just peel off and do their own thing. And everybody who goes back tends to go back because they see it as their last hope, or rather their last chance to live. They're just so unhappy where they are. They want to go back. There's a really interesting passage where they talk about the demographic makeup of everybody. Mm-hmm. And what it comes to, I'm going to see if I can find the bookmark because I loaded up the quotes, but not the bookmark. But long story short, a lot of dudes, whole lot of dudes. It's like a ratio of 4 to 1.
And it's interesting because this whole first part of the book is structured very interestingly. So we get all of these chapters from the point of view of each one of these people and kind of learn a little bit about the very beginnings of their circumstances. And then it kind of in the middle, we get a chapter. It's actually chapter 8 out of 19. So close to the middle. We get a chapter about Madame Guderian, who is, as you said before, the widow of the inventor of the time gate. And this is when we learn that she had originally just started selling access because she needed money at the beginning. And then, you know, she starts to take that money and she builds like a little hotel and some gardens and starts to recognize sort of like the sadness in all of these people who are going back into the past, and eventually goes from being a character who just was in it for the money to somebody who kind of feels like she's, you know, the mother of all of these people. Mm-hmm. And
she feels responsible for them.
Yes. And she gets to the point where she just doesn't want to do it anymore. So she leaves and walks through the time gate herself, leaving a very sort of bitchy note in French, because French is no longer allowed, that just says whatever the French words for are for more than enough. But the milieu was like, no. It's exactly what you just said, Lisa, a safety valve. So they decide to keep it up, and they keep sending people back consistently.
They chuck social troublemakers into it, because what Madame Guderian does, she gets called up before in the chapter that Erica just mentioned. I finally found my bookmark. She gets called up before an investigatory panel, and she says, "I do a work of mercy in this galactic age. It's a blessing. One only needs to study the dossiers of the pathetic ones themselves to see they are out of place in the swift-paced modern world. There have always been such persons, psychosocial anachronisms, unsuited to the age in which they were born. Until the time portal, they had no hope of altering their fate." And then the commissioner says, "Are you so confident, madame, that this time portal leads to a better world?" And then she retorts, "It leads to a different and simpler world, at any rate, citizen commissioner. That seems sufficient to my clients." Mm-hmm. And I love that exchange for a couple of reasons, because it shows you that she's genuinely like conceived of this mission and embraced it. And it's also foreshadowing like crazy.
Yep. Yeah.
When I read it during our reread, I read it and I was like, and I literally said, "Ha!" out loud when I got there. and then we get to the demographics for the people who go. The travelers tend to be literate, socially unconventional, aesthetically sophisticated, and romantic. They're mostly citizens of the old world rather than colonial planets. Mm-hmm. Whole lot of Europeans going on. And fewer agnostics than believers chose to abandon the present. The devout time travelers were often fanatics or conservatives disillusioned about modern religious trends. The psycho profiles of the travelers show the significant percentage of applicants are highly aggressive. Many of the applicants are narcissistic and addicted to fantasy. There was a small but persistent trickle of brokenhearted people. And also they mentioned that because of another one of Madame's strictures, which is that all women who go through the gate have to be sterilized.
Yeah, that was a bit that stood out to me because she doesn't want the daughters of the women who go back to be used and enslaved. And it was one of these little tantalizing bits of information about the present, the galactic milieu, that was never fully explained, because she says, and I jotted this one down as well. She says, "Modern women have complete control of our bodies as well as the ability to defend ourselves from outrage. You will not possess the technology to transfer your reproductive freedom to them. And with the return of the old biological pattern comes also the return of the old biological mindset." And I found that fascinating because I was like, wow, what do future women have that allows them to completely control their bodies? And then I also found myself going, wow, this book really was written a while ago, because there's nothing done to sterilize the men, which to me right now reads as icky as can
be. Would be like the bigger problem, frankly.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. The thing that stood out when I was 18 was at the time I was like, oh, that's a great idea. She's right. There is no birth control. Birth control, what a great technology. And what I thought of this time is the anachronistic or delicate way of pointing out that in the milieu, if a woman is a woman probably has sexual assault is probably rare, but even if it happens, chances are good that the social mores and the legal system have caught up to the radical idea that women shouldn't be assaulted just for having anatomy, which will be completely gone. And then I was reminded of a reread I did of Stephen King's The Stand, where one of the characters ruminates that now that the flu has killed off most of the planet, feminism would be gone too, because it goes back to being a physically aggressive and assertive society, and women couldn't possibly hope to compete. And so I found myself really curious about whatever mindset there was in the 70s and 80s that had just resigned itself to the fact that you were never going to be able to socialize men out of the notion that women were chattel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that seems to still be a core foundational belief Madame has, and that foundational belief seems to be at odds with the idea of a galactic milieu in which everybody has, self-actualization and self-autonomy and all of these other really great social values.
The way that I was able to sort of headcanon it is that, I don't think that it's actually that this holds out, but I have to see it this way in order to still love these books as much as I want to, is that that mindset is actually Madame Guderian's mindset. And she, because she just sort of set it into motion, she's very clearly somebody who is not fully integrated into the new galactic society, because she wants to continue speaking her native French. And so she's an old-fashioned old broad. And I think that her, just because she started this way, sure, after she's gone, the galactic milieu goes along with it, because, you know, that makes sense. From a time travel perspective, they probably are also thinking, we don't want humans going into the past and reproducing, because who knows what's going to happen. It might actually screw up the timeline. We don't know.
I feel like they kind of tie that time traveler paradox thing in a knot really early on, because humanity is going to die out no matter what you do. You can send back as many people as you want. Mm-hmm. Something happens where they don't successfully propagate.
Yeah, which we know, because, you know, the world exists in the state that it does. So,
and perhaps, you know, I'm going to go along with your headcanon, and I'm going to add, perhaps she takes a look at the types of dudes who are going back in time. And she's like, yeah, these guys are going to be totally into, you know, Viking culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the very first, I can't remember if it's the first or the second scene that we have with Stein, who's doing his fantasizing about being a Viking. Like, part of that fantasy is, you know, taking a woman at first against her will, and then she, you know, melts and opens to him, which is grossest. But that is you're right. That is the mindset probably of a good number of the men who have chosen to go back in time. And yeah, like I was saying, structurally, we have that whole Madame Guderian scene in chapter 8. And then the rest of the chapters for the next several are back to a point of view from each person, first Brian, then Stein, then Richard, Felice, Elizabeth. And then slowly after that, she sort of, Julian May sort of abandons the strict point of view, which really, really gets abandoned in part two. Mm-hmm. Yes. And she just sort of goes into a more generalized third person. But we are
third
still learning.
Third person omniscient. Yeah.
Yes. And then we're still learning a little bit more about each of these characters. You know, the first section is learning what their situation is. The second section is learning a little bit more about them as a person and what they think and feel about why they want to go into exile. And then by the last few chapters in part one, we have the group has all come together. They're group green as they go through their like survival training. You know, these are the beasts that you're going to meet when you go back in time. Here are some Decamole bridges and boats. And Decamole is one of the things that has always stuck in my mind from the first time that I read this as just like a futuristic technology that sounds really, really cool. They are able to take matter and basically you get the size of a ping pong ball. And if you use an inflator to pump it up, it pumps enough air in between the molecules and air and or water or sand, because some of it has to be ballasted because it's too light. And you can actually like pump it up and it becomes a huge section of a bridge or an entire cottage that you can like sleep in or a yacht, like any of these things. Like it's the size of something that you can hold in your hand. And because of futuristic technology, you can get all of these cool things and you're able to carry them all back in time with you because plot.
Because plot. It's like Repelvel. The fabric is the one that sticks with me. It's a synthetic, weather resistant fabric.
Mm.
And it's quite fashionable apparently, and it comes up a whole lot. And I've always been like, what is it like? Is it like Gore-Tex? Is it?
Yeah.
It's... But yeah, one of the things that she does really well is she just kind of weaves in these very matter of fact advances and just enough context clues to let you figure out, you know, oh, this is the technology. I have to admit that with this book, like you've said, it's broken down to three parts. The leave taking, the initiation,
and the alliance. The
initiation, and then the alliance. The leave taking might be, I really don't like the initiation section of the book, and you're not supposed to because it's very mm-hmm. upsetting for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
I really love the leave taking section. I love it a whole lot because I love the parts of stories where people are getting ready to go on trips. Like, I have always just gotten very excited, like vicariously, for that sort of thing. And so you get an entire section where it's nothing but like introductions to people and logistics, and I'm all, ooh.
You know, it's interesting because I feel exactly the same way, but I very much did not the first time I read it. I think I may have even mentioned in our intro episode that I had started reading this book and put it down because I didn't like it. And it wasn't the whole of the leave-taking. It was, I think, the first six or seven chapters where you're not getting too much of the inner life of these characters. You're just getting their circumstances and who they are. And they're not tied together in any way. And at that point, it is really just sort of a description of what society is like. And I was kind of bored by it, and it felt a little bit off-putting and cold to me at first. And then when I finally sat down and reread it, I kind of, you know, zipped through that, skimmed it a little bit because I'd already read it. And then I got into like the Madame Guderian chapter and the chapters after that, where you start getting their inner life and the real reasons that they're doing this. And, you know, the information about like Stein, whose father had called him a murdering little animal. And like, that's part of why he's so messed up. And you get all of these hints about who these people are. And that's where I really sort of started to fall in love with it. And I think after the reread, I still love the second half of the leave taking the best, but because I am now looking at it more from a grown-up point of view, and I'm so fascinated by the idea of the milieu itself, I also like the beginning of it. But yeah, to me, whenever I would think back to The Many-Colored Land, that's like the majority of what I would think about was all of these people and their reasons for going, and a little bit of the initiation. I had kind of almost entirely forgotten about the alliance section of it, which we will get to. But I found that it was very interesting that we get to the very, very end of the leave taking, the last chapter before they leave. In chapter 19, you get final thoughts and feelings from every single character, like as they're about to go through the time gate, except Aiken Drum. We don't get any internal life from him. All we get from him is that he inspects the apparatus, like the time travel apparatus, mm-hmm. and asks for a description of it and a diagram of it. And I just thought that was fascinating.
I think the thing I love about him asking for a diagram of it is because he's building an escape valve into his escape valve.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that everybody underestimates with him from the start, everybody in this book consistently thinks he's not as smart as he actually is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's on purpose on his part.
Yeah.
I greatly enjoy this character. That said, like when I read through the leave taking this time out, part of me was thinking, if you were to adapt this this whole thing as a TV series, how would you introduce everybody? And then I thought, oh, you would just kind of do a quick montage, and then maybe there would be flashbacks going through. And then I asked myself, okay, if it's a movie, and then it's one of those things where you have a narrator who's like, Grip Green was, and you have like a pivotal scene from everybody that sums up their character, like Aiken's blowing up a whale, or Stein is busy hacking off the arm of somebody at the Viking reenactment, or, you know, Brian is mooning over Mercy's picture or what have you, but you'd basically get that. And then I was like, how would you do it in comic books? And it's basically the same thing, where it's like everybody gets a full page where it's a scene and a lot of narration that goes with it. And to me, this brought out one of the strengths, which can also be one of the weaknesses because of the same thing of the prose, which is that May is a writer who will not hesitate to describe things in excruciating detail for as long as she wants, if she thinks it's important for you to drink it all in.
Yep.
And that is actually a thing that I struggled with in the initiation.
Dive into part two now.
Oh, God. That was the hardest part for me to get into. And I kept thinking, I have to do it because this is the world building. This is where they find out that, surprise, Earth is actually filled with a race of aliens who were such violent jerk stores, their own universe kicked them out.
Mm-hmm. Basically. You know, I will say that I agree with you, except I thought that the first probably maybe five chapters, five or six chapters still kind of kept me on the hook because, especially the first time through, I didn't know what they had gone back to. I didn't know what was happening. And she's still sort of hanging on to the POV, specific POV structure at this point. Like the first chapter is Brian's point of view and his sort of like anthropologist, viewpoint of what he's seeing and why he thinks things are happening, which of course isn't quite right. And then, you know, Richard, who is recognized, like he as a space sailor recognizes the psychic disorientation that you get going through the gate, and he's not fazed by it. So he's able to like dart away and, you know, he's slowly figuring out what's happening. We get the discovery then in the next chapter of Elizabeth figuring out that like, oh my God, my metafunctions have come back. I'm super disoriented. So there is enough in the first few chapters of like tantalizing details that are sprinkled out in front of you, like, you know, a whole bunch of M&Ms leading you on. And then then when you get to the part where they are finally, they have all been captured and they have been separated into two groups and the fancy people are going south because they have metapsychic powers that were latent for some of them, and this ancient society has technology to lift latent metapsychics up to active operant metapsychics.
I guess if you wanted to transpose it to a sci-fi metaphor, they're effectively cyborgs. They use the technology to augment and extend their brains.
Yep, so. Exactly. So they get to go south, and then the regular old everyday Joes are being sent north to just be regular old workers. And that's when things sort of slowed down for me because, yes, they were describing, like May is describing, she did a lot of research. Like I give her credit, but that's one of the things that kind of bugs me sometimes in books is when the writer has done so much research about the topic that they are writing about that they want you to know about it. And I feel like I didn't need quite so much description of all of these creatures that were alive at that time, of all of the plant life, the geography. Like, you know, the river goes this way and it leads into a lake.
Oh, wow. Instead of the geology too, because there's not just geography, there's geology where they're talking about different types of rocks and you're like, enough.
So that is where it sort of slows down for me. Was that the case for you, or did you also find like the beginning bits of the initiation kind of slow?
So since it was a reread, I knew what was coming, and I feel like some of the visceral oh my God was kind of lost. So I tried to read it with the question, all right, how would I react if I read it for the first time now? Mm-hmm. And I could appreciate the way that she paced it and she structured it. But yeah, there's a lot of showing your work. And I have to say, as somebody who took breaks from reading this by trying to finish up Neal Stephenson's latest, I am more than familiar with the show your work syndrome at this point.
Wow, you've been bathing in it, basically.
Yeah, no, I feel like I'm doing the backstroke, which is when your arm goes out at approximately.
Oh, God. Well played.
Yeah. What I do like is that she just keeps the shocks coming for like the first six chapters. Like the jabs are really short and nasty and persistent. Elizabeth regains her metafunctions and is like, son of a monkey! Amory, the nun, and Felice, the person who seems to have extremely screwed up perspectives about human relationships, discover to their horror that they're going to become breeding stock because The Tanu, i.e. the alien, one of the two alien species, the Tanu have figured out a way to reverse all of the human sterilizations. So that's horrible, because no sooner do the women come through the gate than they're told that they're going to give up all bodily autonomy to the state until they're no longer needed. And you realize that these people have gone from a world in which they were probably just, not just, but they were... The most severe challenges they had were of emotional and social sorts, mm-hmm. and they've been flung backwards by their own choice into a world where they're going to be in profound physical danger, either through forced breeding programs or through gladiatorial schemes or through hard labor. And what's worse, there is a race of psychic aliens who have a fairly brutal and physically violent culture to enforce the rules. So, like, once I got past the long, becalmed stretches of homework, I you know, the horror of it all sunk in a way it hadn't when I was a teenager. Because mm-hmm. I think when you're young and you're reading these books, you're like, oh, they'll do something about it. They're young. It's a quest, you know,
adventure.
It's a quest. Yeah, adventure. And then when you're older, and like you've had time to live with your own consequences, you're like, oh my God, this is awful. And then you think, holy crap, people have been coming into this for 60 years. Like for 60 years, all of these hurting and disillusioned people have come through a gate and effectively provided fodder for these imperial battle aliens.
Yep.
And it's appalling. Like, it's just, oh.
It is. And you're right. It didn't really hit me as hard the first time or two that I read it. But this time it very much did, for all the reasons you said. The terrible irony that is called out a lot more more specifically in the book is Elizabeth's personal irony, the fact that she had to leave the galactic milieu because she had lost her connection with Unity, and she was alone, and she zaps back through the gate, and it kickstarts her metafunctions into operancy once again, and she is in this world where there is there's nobody else. She at one point she says she's listening for quote unquote true people, all one word, and immediately scolds mm-hmm. herself for even yeah. having that thought, because there are other people and creatures who are operant metapsychics, but many of them are aliens, and the rest of them are people who were only latent and only have, you know, cyborg technology to make them operant. So she is totally alone in the exact opposite way of what she was mm-hmm. before. And yeah, that irony is much more spelled out and is also cruel, although less horrific, I think, than what the women are going through.
It's less and more horrific, because you find out over the course of this book, and it's amplified more in the next book, and we'll talk about that with later with the spoiler horn. But you find out that the Tanu, there are two races of aliens who land on the planet, the Tanu and the Fervalog. The Tanu are basically like tall, beautiful, like imagine the elves in the Lord of the Rings. They're basically yep. all like imagine if Orlando Bloom were 7 feet tall. There's your Tanu. Orlando Bloom in the Lord of the Rings. Boop, there he goes. Or Lee Pace, who I think would make an excellent Tanu.
Yeah.
And then the Fervalog are basically not nearly so good looking, but slightly more psychic. They don't need
they're more like dwarves.
They don't need cyborg technology. They're dwarves, they're trolls, they're ogres, they're little people. Mm-hmm. And
they have, and like you said, they are operant. They don't have the full range so much of psychic abilities, but they're very good illusionists. They can drive people mad with fear by putting thoughts and feelings directly into their head. So they are, and they're very much just like she dribbles out the word Fervalag a couple of times throughout the beginning of this section as sort of like the boogeyman. And you know, people are asking, why do you have such strong walls around these castles? Like, I know that there are beasts and stuff, but they don't seem like they'd be that bad. And the humans can't possibly have too many weapons. And then, you know, somebody would be like, Fervalag. And then that's it. Until you actually get to learn a little bit more about what they are, in what I think is a really interesting chapter, in the midst of the travel, when Elizabeth helps to separate the two, one of the Tanu women she's not a Tanu woman, she's a human woman who is married to a Tanu man, and she's pregnant with twins, and these twins are basically
psychically intertwined.
Yes, and Elizabeth, because she is such a strong redactor, a psychic healer, she is able to disentangle their minds, which was a very difficult thing because they are so very antagonistic toward each other. And she is able to disentangle them and get them apart, and then they're born, and she sees that one of them is Tanu and the other one is Fervalag, which apparently doesn't happen super often, but we also later find out that Tanu women give birth to Fervalag once in every three births. And
once every four. It's a really high recidivism rate.
Yeah, I think it's one in every three for them, and then for a Tanu man siring a child on a human woman, it's only one in every seven. This is part of the reason that they are using women, human women, as birth horses, basically, because they don't want to give birth to as many of their counterparts, the Fervalag, and also apparently Earth's radiation is somewhat harmful to their systems. So their birth rate has dropped considerably since they have landed on this planet
because of the radiation. What it's worth noting we haven't talked about so far is that this faction of Tanu and this faction of Fervalag were, again, kicked out of their galaxy for being raging jerk stores. They had what was called a battle religion, where their entire belief system is predicated on giant ritual battles every year, whereby ritual we mean real, people bleed and die. Mm-hmm. And the Tanu and the Fervalag are actually a product of dimorphic evolution. The Tanu were down in like foggy lowlands, and for whatever reason that made them grow very tall and slender. And the Fervalag were populating high mountain reaches. So they're shorter, they're hardier. There's really dramatic mental differences. There's really dramatic physical differences based on, I guess, millennia of living in these very specific climates. And, when it is one section of we love to battle Fervalag and one section of we love to battle Tanu against the rest of a galaxy that's like, no, knock it off. Mm-hmm. These two factions get together on a ship that is like, I think there is a place that you can live, and then like makes the leap from their galaxy and crash lands on Earth. So effectively, you have two antagonists who were united for a moment because their mutual goal was, let's get out of the galaxy. And now that that goal has been met, they have been locked in enmity in the millennia since. As of right now, the Tanu have the upper hand because they were the ones who capitalized on the time gate and figured out that, hey, it brings in cool stuff and it brings in people who know things, and we can use their brains and their stuff and their uteruses to rebuild our civilization and give ourselves a leg up in all of these annual battles and rituals that we have. And so that's effectively what they've been doing. It's I would say there's a metaphor for colonialism in there, mm-hmm. and the unfair advantages of exploiting people and resources to gain greater dominance in a global culture, because that is sure how it reads now. But again, when I was 18, I wasn't looking at it that way. It was more like a, hey. And again, when I was 18, like, the full horror of what they're asking of these people hadn't really sunk in, because again, it's an adventure. Mm-hmm. What ho, it's a quest. And this time I'm reading through and I'm like, wow, when your best case scenario is perhaps I can escape in the middle of the night and live in the woods until something kills me, like, oh my god.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How many people who have gone through that gate do you think regretted it at this point?
Yep. Although it's really interesting too that she makes it clear that there are an awful lot of people who are perfectly comfortable with this lifestyle. They they are either, you know, just doing their crafting or serving and perfectly happy with it because they have you know, nice houses to live in and plenty of food.
Their torque gives them like all sorts of mental zaps for the better too. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah, that's one thing we haven't mentioned is the colors of the torque. So the golden torque is what the Tanu men and women use to bring themselves up to operancy. There is a silver torque, which will take a human man or woman, human person, and make their latent powers operant. However, there are control circuits in the silver torque, and anyone with a gold torque can basically control anybody who has a silver torque. Then there are gray torques, which are given to select people who don't have any kind of metapsychic powers at all. So it's just control circuits, and that's all it is. So they give those to anybody who would be like a soldier or a guard.
Skilled workers, I think, is a fair way of putting it.
The really important pieces of society, the people that the Tanu cannot afford to lose. And in addition to control, like you just said, yes, the gray torques are able to get into the pleasure centers and also the pain centers of the minds of whoever is wearing them. And once you have put it on, you can't take it off because it's actually just like become a part of your psyche.
It's like linked to your neural circuit somehow.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And it also allows you an almost perverse form of unity because you can feel mm-hmm. other people's emotions. You can communicate with other people too.
It's like a pale echo of what the Galactic Milieu Society has going on.
It's worth noting that if you are a gray torque, you can probably reach out for communication. Like you can send a call for help. You can respond to requests. You can extend your feelings to other gray torque wearers. But in terms of, you know, who's who in torques, it's best to have a gold torque because this gives you the power to send, receive, and control anybody else who has a silver or a gray torque. If you're a silver torque, you can persuade and you can exert control over gray torques. Mm-hmm. And you also have a higher range of meta faculties. And then if you're a gray torque, you're basically like, I'm just in it for the kicks. Mm-hmm. And with luck, I don't get coerced.
I know I'm jumping ahead, but at the very end, at the very, very end of the book, the humans have determined that a way to take the torques off, they could use iron, and many people choose not to lose their gray torque. They would rather be killed than give up this sense of unity and this ability to serve their masters, the Tanu, who are able to give them pleasure.
Yeah, to jump ahead to a synopsis of part three of the book, what we discover is that Madame, thanks to her, like, leaving in the middle of the night, she actually escapes collection by the Tanu. Mm-hmm. You know, I keep on saying Tanu.
because they have been, you know, it's been at dawn every morning, you know, new people show up, like, every day or once a week or whatever it is. And
time to go collect this week's collection.
And she's, Madame needs to sneak away from her employees, so she goes in the middle of the night, and thus she escapes the Tanu as well, which is a nice touch.
And so, long story short, she looks at what's going on, and she's like, oh my god, these people are all suffering, and it's because they wouldn't be here if I didn't let them be here. I bear this huge responsibility. People are propagating a lot of evil, and I assisted. And even though I did so unknowingly, I still assisted. So it's my responsibility to found a resistance, and it's my responsibility to atone for what I did. And I won't stop until I feel like I fully atoned and until people are genuinely free, not the illusion of freedom I had before. And so you find this out about Madame in the back third of the book, and you find out more about what they're called low lives, people who don't live in Tanu villages or Tanu cities and operate within the culture are called low lives, which I thought was a nice linguistic way. It was a great way for the Tanu to give their collaborators a little jolt of moral superiority. Well, at least in the low life. So you find out about the low lives. They actually managed to successfully overrun a Tanu city. And the end of the book, they teach some fighting techniques to the Fervalog, who are kind of conditional allies because the Fervalog have been getting wiped by the Tanu and are ready to turn the tables. And thus book one ends with the Tanu realizing that there are humans who have become more dangerous because they have finally found quote unquote blood metal, which can harm the Tanu. And by the end of the book, Richard has found a sort of partial redemption because he falls in love with a woman who was used as a broodmare until her health practically gave out. She dies over the course of the invasion. Grief-stricken, he takes off in a shuttle and just decides to orbit the Earth until his air runs out. So Group Green is already down one. It's still separated. A couple people already confirmed to be working for Low Lives. And it's kind of a cliffhanger because while this is going on, Elizabeth and Aiken and Brian are all in the clutches of Tanu civilization.
Yep. Yeah. It even ends saying, basically, you know, after the end of the last chapter, you know, please read The Golden Torque, which has more of the story of the Group Green folks who went north.
Yeah. So I feel like this book is a real table setter for the whole series because it sets up what is going to be your big conflict, which is how are humanity going to shake off the shackles of the aliens who are enslaving them? And then we have at least seven characters in Group Green in whose fates we are still heavily invested. And we are beginning to meet other species and other inhabitants. Like we meet a bunch of the Tanu. We discover there's some court intrigues that are beginning to spin out. We discover the Tanu have their own small conflicts and their own small motivations. And we're nicely set up for another book, which is basically what's going to happen when the Tanu, like how are the Tanu going to respond to this renewed threat?
Yep.
And more importantly, now that Madame has her hands on a paleontologist, how does this even out the fight?
Yeah, I think the bit of part three, the alliance that I like the best is actually at first you think it's the alliance between these new members of Group Green and the Low Lives, but it moves along and you realize no, the real alliance and the important one is for now is the Low Lives being allied with the Fervalag, who are led by Yeochi, High King of the Fervalag, which is a great name. And and you have some scenes where Yeochi the King is talking to Fitharn, a.k.a. Pegleg, who is a Fervalag who's missing part of one of his legs. And they're basically talking about how they are going to use these humans for as long as makes sense. And then, you know, once they don't need them anymore, kill them all so that nobody can take advantage of them or at least make sure that they are in control and ruling them. So you definitely have like this, like you said, sort of court intrigue. It's very much that these two factions don't really trust each other, but they've made this alliance. And at the same time, we have the discovery of iron being deadly, not only to the Tanu, but also to the Fervalag, as we learn. So that makes, you know, it's sort of like another nail in the coffin for that alliance. You know, how long is it going to last after this? Now knowing that the humans have a weapon that, honestly, it's just a pinprick. Like, that's all it takes. Yeah. And down they go. There's a very interesting little section talking about mythology and how it's often said that iron is antithesis. It's very bad for fairies. Yep. So there's an awful lot of borrowed mythology, which I very much appreciate being kind of a nerd.
Oh, me too. And I have to say, I will give these books credit. At 18, I knew I liked fairy tales and mythology. And owing to, I guess, the limitations of the public libraries we had and the schooling I had, I was fluent in Greek mythology, but I didn't know much about Norse or Celtic mythology. And these hit about the same time I started reading Guy Gavriel Kay's work. Ah. And that led me into Arthurian legends and Irish mythology and Celtic mythology. And they were like a real gateway drug. And now, you know, you go back and you read them after having read here and there. And this is where she did her homework, but she showed and didn't tell. And I really appreciate that so much.
Yes. And I also appreciate that you don't need to know really any of it. Like, it doesn't, you know, whether we're talking about the, you know, any of the mythology that sort of plays into this, it doesn't matter whether or not you know it, because she is explaining what it means for these characters in these ways. It's just sort of like extra seasoning. If you happen to know about the iron thing, or you happen to know about, you know, succubus, the legend of the succubus, you know, having sex with men and stealing their souls or their life
vitality.
Force.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's this one poor man who becomes friends with Stein and falls prey to the Tanna women are, for lack of a better word, voracious. Mm-hmm. And they love human men because human men are not affected by radiation the same way Tanna men are. And so this poor Finnish lumberjack just gets passed around and used and abused. But overall, like I said, I got the sense that this book is very much a table setting book. The big adventure, as it were, or rather the through line for this book was, how does half of a group green manage to escape from a life of servitude and slavery? And what is the exciting new conflict they find themselves in? But like, that's just to get people reading to the end of the book. This book as a whole is basically, here is the setup that we expect to carry us through the rest of the tetralogy.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And this comes back from, you know, you read more, you begin to understand how series are structured as opposed to books. The first time I read this book, I didn't quite get that sense of table setting. And I think the reason I got it this time was because, since I already had a little bit of foreknowledge to the series, this book didn't feel quite so complete as it had the last time I read it. This book definitely felt like, again, the table setting book, where you're like, okay, if I put in the time now and understand everything, then there will be payoffs down the line for the next three books.
I think for me, it also was the different kind of reader I was at the time. I think if I read this book for the very first time now, I think I would see the sort of table setting nature of it, because I have read so many more books and so many more series and paid attention to them from a structural standpoint. At the time, I really saw the journey that happened in part three of the of our folks trying to get to this ship and the spear, which turns out to be a really badass weapon, so that they can take on one of the cities and knock it out just before before there's a truce that happens between the Tanu and the Fervalag, where they don't fight each other before their giant old
before they fight each other.
Yep, their big old battle. So they're able to do this. They find it, and you know, Richard and Martha fix up the ship, and they fall in love, and that's all very nice. And then you get the epic battle scene at the end, which it doesn't matter if it's a book or a TV show or a movie. I'm usually a little bit bored by those, but I am socialized to understand and to believe and to feel that the big epic battle scene is the climactic ending of the story. So it did feel like it was a decent end for this first book to go through that big battle scene and have our heroes succeed and win. And, you know, it's pretty epic and it's pretty cool until you get the falling action where Richard is sad and finds Martha's body in the chapel and then takes her into the flyer and just flies off.
It's very English patient.
I have not read nor seen that, so I'm going to take your word.
it's very the English patient, because now that I think on it, one of the things that I also wanted to two things that I wanted to bring up before we start, you know, sound the spoiler horn and talk about the series as a whole. But two things I wanted to bring up were, I felt a lot more visceral horror this time around, and visceral dread, and than I did is, because again, like you said, adventure. Like when I was 18, part of it was like, oh, I can't wait to see what happens next, and oh my gosh, this is a complication. And I thought to myself, if I read this book for the first time, given how upsetting some of these plot developments and world-building elements are, when you really sit with them for a minute or two, I was like, would I stay with this series now? Or has it gotten to the point where my own experiences and reactions impede my ability to fall into a story to the extent that I could when I was a teenager?
Ooh, that is a fascinating question. I don't even think I could answer it for myself, because I imprinted so strongly on it the first few times.
I was trying to think about, you know, when was the last time I fell into a fiction series and just stayed there, and what did it? And you know, again, it occurred to me that when you come back to this, you can appreciate it on a structural level in a way that I didn't before. And I can appreciate the pacing, and I can appreciate her skilled use of foreshadowing and her rich and extensive vocabulary. Just her capacity for description is fantastic. But you know, there are parts of it where I just find it so emotionally, it's not even manipulative. It's just, it's so, it hit me so viscerally. I was like, oh my gosh. Wow. How did I not feel this way about this book the first time? How is it that I was able to fall in love with the story? And I don't remember being upset about any of this. And the answer was because I didn't know enough to be that emotionally reactive to it. The other thing that I noticed this time that I hadn't noticed much as an 18-year-old is none of the characters in Group Green end the book with the same sense of self or mindset as which they start in which they started. I think, you know, we see Richard learn how to fall in love with somebody and feel outrage for something someone else has done to them. Like he actually expands his sphere of empathy a little bit. To his detriment, as it turns out. But, you know, Richard loves and he loses. We see Aiken get his metafaculties augmented. And although he comes off as still being that same hyper-crafty, very smart, irrepressible type, he's now more than he used to be in a very real sense. We see that Claude and Amory are struggling to reframe their systems of belief and knowledge in a world that doesn't make sense to them.
And Emery really has an epiphany about why she became a nun in the first place. You know, she had this donkey trip into and out of the Grand Canyon as a child. And after that, her parents, she injured herself because she was clamping so hard to try to help the poor donkey and was injured and could not go along with her family when they left the planet she was going to follow, and they all died, and she felt this guilt, and that, you know, that led directly to her becoming a nun, which led directly to her wanting to enter exile, which led to her directly to her being in this world where she is going to be used as a broodmare. And I thought that was really interesting. That was called out a little bit more specifically than some of the other developments that we got. I liked hers.
But, you know, you see Claude kind of go into this whole thing with the sense of confidence with this is, I have studied, I've dedicated a century of my life to this. What could possibly be here that I couldn't handle? I've camped rough for years. I know everything about this era. And now he has to think, all right, there were no aliens in the fossil record. Right. And so you see that sort of challenge. And then Elizabeth, of course, is knocked back online with her metafaculties. And Stein gets redacted. And we find out that the big source of his psychic trauma was he caused a fatal accident where his mother was killed. And his father, in his grief and his sorrow, like took it out of the kid completely wrongly. It's made abundantly clear. But he's, by the end of this, he's free of that hurt. Like Elizabeth and a woman who later becomes Stein's wife, Suki, Elizabeth and Suki team up to cure him.
And he's able to see, they're able to dig into his brain enough so that he's able to relive it and watch his father, you know, call him a murdering animal, and then immediately walk that back and say, oh my God, my poor little son, I'm so sorry I said that. But it had imprinted on him so strongly that he was never able to get through the, I don't know, psychic scar tissue to be able to see that.
Yeah. So, and by the end of the book, Stein is willing to put his life on the line for his wife. He's become the type of guy where instead of dreaming about rampant conquest and taking and pillaging, when he's actually in a culture that does have rampant conquest and taking and pillaging, he's like, no, I'm here to protect what I care about. And so, you know, he's changed. Like these characters, and then Felice has gone deeper into her incipient madness, as it were, because by the end of the book, she's like, I cannot wait to kill something. I cannot wait to get my own gold torque. I am gonna take the Tanu and they're gonna die at my hand. Like all of them. Ain't gonna be a Tanu left when I'm done. And like the anger that she has just gotten so big by the end of the book and so much more sharply focused.
Yeah, she is. We haven't even talked about the fact that, you know, she has been salivating for a golden torque through as soon as she realizes what they are and what they do. She knows she has latent metafaculties and she wants a torque because she wants to take them all on. And again, she is thwarted and she's not able to get it. So she's literally like ends the book literally running toward the battle, hoping to find a dead Tanu that she can pull a torque off of, basically.
So she can. Yeah. And we find out that she knew she had latent metafaculties because it turns out that she can control animals.
Yes.
Or that they're the only living beings with which she can truly connect. So, but I hadn't noticed at 18 that everybody's sense of self and sense of and the way they make sense of the world, like all of those things shift with everybody in Group Green.
Yep.
With the exception of Brian, I would hazard. Brian stays the same.
Right. And he's he is the only one who leaves because he is chasing a person, not a state of being. And he doesn't find that person. Mercedes does not appear again in this book. So he doesn't have the opportunity to make any kind of change because he hasn't found the thing that he is looking for, nor has he found that the thing that he is looking for does not never has existed. Whereas everybody else gets to this place and discovers, oh, that thing that I wanted, that is not what this is. He discovers, oh, Mercedes is alive. She's somewhere here and I'm going to go and find her. He just doesn't get to that point yet. So it makes sense that he doesn't have a transformation in the way that everybody else does.
Yeah. I hadn't really noticed the scope or the nature of that transformation when I was a younger reader.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for me, it was like, oh, they've made this stop on their journey. And it didn't really occur to me to understand or appreciate how psychically and emotionally these characters had moved from point A to point B or point A to point G or wherever they are along their arc until much, much later. So I'd have to say with the reread, one of the reasons I'm glad I'm rereading it is so I can actually, I feel like I'm gaining a deeper appreciation for the work that Julian May has put into these books, mm-hmm. and the choices she's made and how she lays this stuff out. Because at 18, I loved the storytelling because she's a good storyteller and she's got a lot of detail and the characters are compelling. And at 18, I love that. And now in my 40s, I'm like, oh, wow, the skill.
Yeah. Yeah. It's harsh.
It's so good. Like you just, it's a good thing that young writers don't realize how hard it is to write like that, or else nobody would ever try. I mean, mm-hmm. it's just really good.
All right. Well, we should probably dive into spoiler territory. So if you are reading along with us book by book and you do not want to have the rest of the series spoiled, I recommend that you get in your spacecraft and fly away and come back when you've read all the books. Right now, I want Lisa to tell me how this book sits in the entirety of all four of these books, which I discovered that you have read all of.
Like I was telling you, either before we started recording or on the bootleg when I was still having problems with my headphones, I read the first book and then was like, oh, I got to find out what happened to everyone else. And I started reading because I finished the first book like last Friday. And so Friday night, I started The Golden Torque, which is the second book. And at 2 a.m., I was finally like, oh, I should get to bed. And long story short, I spent all of last weekend reading, like just gulping the rest of the series. I'm going to have to go back and reread, I think. But it was pretty much like every time Phil or, you know, Trix came by, I'm like, I'm in a novel. This is so good. I haven't been this immersed in a while. And this is actually my least favorite of the four books.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And I think it's my least favorite because, again, it's a lot of table setting.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time you get to books number 3 and 4, there's just so many resolutions and so many payoffs that just boom, 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 that, you know, you're like, oh, wow. So, you know, I loved reading it. I think if you wanted to, in a way, you could probably blend this book with The Golden Torque. Because there's almost a natural division with the first two books and the second two books, because books number 3 and 4 introduce a considerable complication / literal deus ex machina that help push towards a resolution. But
yeah, I wonder if in today's day of publishing and the books being giant doorstops and stuff, if they would have opted to just publish them together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. The other thing I was thinking as I read the first book and then read through the other three is it seems to me, and this is where, like, my curse you, pre-internet publishing, like, these four books seem to be almost a historical analog for how Christianity became the dominant cultural religion of European culture, of Europe. Like, especially since, like, in the first few books, there's a lot of heavy-duty Greek imagery. Like, a lot of times the Tanu are at one point, there's a dinner in one of the future books in which the king and queen are repeatedly described as Jovian and Junoesque, which is a clear nod to Jove, a.k.a. Jupiter, a.k.a. Zeus. And Juno is, of course, Hera. And there's a lot of real parallels between the Greek pantheon of gods and the Tanu. And then by the end of the book, there's just a really explicit Christian message of it. And as I took a look at the way they set up the Tanu culture and then how the Tanu culture is gradually overthrown and superseded by what follows it, I was like, holy carp, this basically echoes the history of the church succeeding the Roman Empire as a cultural force in Europe. I would love to know if Julian May meant that on purpose or if this is her just like subconsciously reflecting the liberal arts education she had. Catholicism plays a huge role in her thematic embroidering. So I don't even know, but she died a couple years ago and I can't find any records of any interviews where people asked her about this sort of thing. So it's one of the things where I'm just left to wonder, but oh my gosh, like, I really enjoyed this book and I loved rereading it for all of the reasons you talk about, because you begin to understand more about yourself as a reader. It's nice to revisit your old reading self and see what's changed at the same time too. But wow, like reading the series as a whole was kind of a mind bender when you're like, oh, look at all the things she wrote into it.
I think for me, I haven't reread these for a while. So for me, I think this is the one that I always remember the most. And I think in part that's me as a reader, as a consumer of media. I always tend to like the beginnings best. If there's a trilogy, I'm almost always going to like the first book or the first movie the best. And it'll be interesting for me to see as we go through this if that holds true with this, or if the fact that I have sort of evolved as a reader will make that sort of table setting idea so clear with this book that I am more excited to get on to the meat of the story, as it were, or if I'm really just going to be that excited about the, we're going on an adventure, it's all getting started, everything's kicking off, and if that's going to still be the thing that stays closest to my heart. I'm interested to discover.
Me too. I can't wait to get your reaction. I'm like you in that I always get very excited by beginnings. And I think one of the reasons I get excited about beginnings is because I'm always so eager to see, like, the possibilities and potentials are still spread out before you, like a banquet. And then as you go through, you know, a series, gradually the number of dishes in that banquet get taken away. And at the end of it, you have to ask, was that an okay meal? Because it's just been narrowed down to this sequence of five dishes or what have you. And so, yeah, I find beginnings to be really exciting because anything could happen after that.
Yep. It's the potential. You're setting the table, and the meal could be the greatest meal of your entire life. You just don't know yet.
You don't know, but the possibility's there, and that possibility is always so exciting. It's the optimism of the it's the optimism of the reader, or the optimism of the audience, whatever you want to call it. I love it too. I think that's what keeps us coming back to new works, is there's always the chance, you know?
Yep. So true.
So, oh my gosh, Erica, I've had so much fun talking about this with you, and I cannot wait until you read book two with me. We can do the next one.
I am so excited. Yeah. I was excited to reread it, but then going through and actually like digging into it and just, you know, taking notes and keeping track of what was happening, I was like, wow, this is even better than I remembered. Yeah. Just the layers and the characters and all of that. And I can't wait to get to see some of the other characters that we didn't see as much in this book, and the tantalizing hints of memory that I have, like, oh, I feel like this is going to happen to that guy. And I feel like this is going to happen to Elizabeth. And I need to get there. I need to.
Yeah.
All right. Well, until next time, thank you, everybody, for listening. We appreciate you being along for this ride. I hope you are reading along with us. If not, well, I hope you're enjoying the podcast. So until next time, I've been Erica.
I've been Lisa.
And thank you for joining us on this epic journey. Saga of Rereading Epics is a proud part of the Incomparable Podcast Network. visit theincomparable.com for more geeky podcasts. And while you're there, you can become a member, support the show, and get future episodes of this podcast right now.